Hi, this is Randy Landry, and this is my podcast, common-sense-america.com, and today I'm going to be reading from a premise article, Why We Shouldn't Cancel the Supreme Court. Sorry, it's been a while, but I've been very busy, and I said quite a few months ago that I was going to make my podcast just once in a while, not a scheduled one, though that may change in the near future. I might actually convert to video. So there, it used to be in Buzzsprout. I've been doing this for about 5 years now, but now all you have to do is, as I just stated in my blog article address, all you have to do once you get to the blog is type in the category podcasts. And you will see all my articles or podcasts that I've published over the years. And you can just pick and choose to listen to which ones you want to. The good thing is a lot of the books I have written are also in the audiobook form. And they are in that podcast category. So without any further ado, let me start. This article was written by Jonathan Turley. Author, Rage and the Republic, The Unfinished Story of the American Revolution. Nothing quite says popular justice like a good old-fashioned guillotine. Across the country, protesters have dragged around makeshift guillotines as they call for radical and revolutionary changes to our constitutional system. The symbol of the French Revolution remains a chilling reminder of how revolutions devour their own. What is even more unnerving than though these prop guillotines is the increase in calls for radical and revolutionary changes, including the elimination or the packing of the Supreme Court, trashing the Electoral College, and doing away with the U.S. Senate by establishment figures on the left. I want to just pause for a second here and say that I have discussed previously about getting rid of the Electoral College. We're the only country that has this. So obviously it's a vestige of a bygone time. And you know how I feel about it. I think actually we should get rid of it. It's an unfair system. And what it does is it promotes focusing on certain key states, and the rest of them are just left dangling without any kind of representation, basically, when it comes to these big elections. So I think if we got rid of the Electoral College, it would force each candidate to go to every other, all 50 states, and campaign in each and every one of them. They don't want to do that because it would be a lot of work and cost a lot of money. But it would be more fair, at least these other states, the Passover states, as we call them, or flyovers, I would actually get some time, airtime. All right, so continue on. Today's attacks on the American judiciary do indeed harken back to the rhetoric that raged before the advent of the terror in revolutionary France. The rhetoric that gave rise to the kind of mobocracy that the founders sought to avoid by designing our constitutional order as they did. To help understand this, it is useful to recall the fundamental differences between the American Revolution, which led to the world's oldest and most prosperous republic, and the French Revolution, which led to a short-lived, blood-soaked tyranny. Both revolutions were based on Enlightenment ideas, but America's revolution was closely tied to the political philosophy of John Locke, who held that our rights come not from the government, but from the God. The institutional arrangements of the Constitution, including the independent court system, were designed to protect these God-given individual rights. Conversely, the French Revolution was inspired in the end not by Lockean principles, but by the political philosophy of Jean-Jacques Rousseau, which extolled the general will of the people and opposed institutions, including courts, that interfered with that will. This concept of a general or popular will served as a license for French revolutionaries like Robespierre, who declared that terror is only justice, prompt, severe, and inflexible, a natural consequence of the general principle of democracy, to unleash a torrent of executions that would eventually come to turn on the revolutionaries themselves. There is a radical movement rising in the U.S. with chilling parallels to the French Revolution. Demands for the elimination or packing of the Supreme Court and other measures are ripped from the French Revolutionary Handbook. Most worrisome is the surrender of establishment figures, particularly in promising to make radical changes to the Supreme Court. Indeed, offering the Supreme Court up to this movement has become a litmus test for Democratic presidential candidates. Former Vice President Kamala Harris, former Secretary of Transportation Pete Buttigieg, and U.S. Representative Ro Khanna have embraced it. Harris and California Governor Gavin Newsom have characterized reluctance to change the court as nostalgia and have warned that nostalgia is not working. The platform of the increasingly influential Democratic Socialists of America calls both for dissolving the Supreme Court and for creating a unicameral legislature by eliminating the U.S. Senate. Much of this is animated by undisguised power politics. Here's former Attorney General Eric Holder arguing that packing the Supreme Court should be made a priority. We're talking about the acquisition and the use of power if there is a Democratic trifecta in 2028. And Democratic strategist James Carville, if the Democrats win the presidency and both houses of Congress, I think on day one they should expand the Supreme Court to 13. Eat our dust, don't run on it, don't talk about it, just do it. Harvard Law School professor Michael Klarman has laid out an agenda by which the Democrats can guarantee that they will never lose another election, but warns that the Supreme Court could strike down everything that agenda consists of. Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren has characterized the court as illegitimate because it has rendered decisions against what she sees as widely held public opinion. Former U.S. Representative Eric Swalwell similarly objected that the court defies the will of the people. U.S. Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who is now leading in some Democratic presidential polls, asked why we even have a Supreme Court. How much does the current structure benefit us? I don't think it does. Actually, there's something to be said about that. All the lower courts seem to do whatever the hell they want, regardless of whether or not whatever the Supreme Court says. I mean, the Supreme Court makes a ruling and says that the lower courts cannot change the presidential rulings in districts that they don't control, and yet they go ahead and still do it. It's almost like a paper tiger. So unless the Supreme Court gets some real power to actually do something, enforce these laws, then it's useless. I mean, it showed under Biden's administration, they chose which laws they wanted to enforce. That's the presidential branch, what they're supposed to do, right? So if the Supreme Court can't enforce their laws or their rulings, what good are they? It's just like it's an honor system. It's whether or not the president in office decides he wants to back it up. And also, there's 13 district courts. So would that not be bad to have 13 Supreme Court justices, one that oversees each one of the courts, and they can like mentor those that are in that court system? Maybe then we'd have a little bit more control over those district courts. It's something to say about it. I mean, what's to stop the Republican Party right now and the president in office from actually fitting 13 justices and then put a limit at 13? Okay. So I don't know. There's something to be said about that. Some of these ideas are not terrible, provided they're managed the right way. The irony is that these calling to pack the court say it will make the court less partisan. Buttigieg has suggested not only expanding the court from 9 to 15 justices, but also having each party appoint 5 members, with those 10 justices then selecting the remaining 5. Such a court would then operate like the federal election system currently does, which party loyalists voting the party line. This way of thinking runs completely counter to our nation's founding principles. A nonpartisan, independent judiciary serves 2 essential purposes. It plays a vital role in preserving the separation of powers, which prevents all government power from being concentrated in one place, and it stands as a bulwark in defense of minority rights against a majority faction. To ensure its ability to perform these essential roles without being threatened by the political branches, the Congress and the executive branch, the Constitution gives federal jurists life tenure and salary protections. Despite these structural protections early in our nation's history, there were few professional standards governing the American court system. Courts were openly biased, with federalist judges becoming virtual grand inquisitors of Jeffersonians under the infamous Alien and Sedition Acts passed during the presidency of John Adams. Judges and justices routinely ran for political office and openly engaged in political commentary from the bench. But this would change. The first university-based law school in the U.S. was founded in 1779 at the College of William and Mary in Williamsburg, Virginia, and America's first independent law school was created in 1784 in Litchfield, Connecticut. Relatively quickly, the partisanship that characterized the courts came to be tempered by professional standards that eschewed political associations and advocacy. Even today, regardless of the charges hurled against the Supreme Court by both the right and the left, what critics call partisanship is actually deep and good faith jurisprudential differences on both sides of the court. This was also the case when, for a period of many decades, the court had a liberal majority. And during that period, even during the years of the Warren Court in the 1950s and 60s, when conservative precedents were overturned in large numbers and conservatives were often outraged, there were virtually no calls to pack or eliminate the court. During the confirmation hearings for Neil Gorsuch in 2017, I had an exchange with a Democratic senator who rattled off a series of 5-4 decisions to show that conservative justices were robotic partisans. I asked the senator if the 4 liberal justices showing the same consistency in dissent were also partisans. The reaction was disbelief. After all, the liberal justices were right in his eyes. In reality, the attack on the court as partisan is entirely disconnected from its actual voting record. It is too little known fact that 44% of cases that came before the Supreme Court are decided unanimously. When you include only nearly unanimous cases, those decided by an 8-1 and 7-2 margins, that figure jumps to over 60%. It is also common for liberal and conservative justices to vote with the colleagues on the opposite end of the ideological spectrum. In a case this year, for example, conservative justices Thomas Alito and Kavanaugh joined liberal justices Sotomayor and Jackson in the majority decision, while liberal justice Kagan joined Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Barrett in the dissent. Liberal justices from Stephen Breyer to Elena Kagan have refuted claims that today's court is a partisan institution. Justice Kagan, as reported in Politico, spoke recently on this topic and rejected claims that the high court's conservative majority is in President Donald Trump's corner. The fact is that the ongoing enthusiasm for packing or eliminating the Supreme Court is based less on the voting records and views of the justice than on the idea, as Senator Warren put it, that the court should follow what she perceives as widely held public opinion. For those on both ends of the political spectrum, judicial restraints on their favored policies can be frustrating or even infuriating. And sometimes, as history shows, the court can get things wrong. On the other hand, those restraints often represent a firewall for natural rights. Considering the attacks on free speech that came to a head during the Biden administration, when a coalition of forces and government, academia, and corporations created the largest censorship system in the history of our country. Free speech, as guaranteed in the First Amendment, has been understood throughout our history, almost universally among Americans, as a bedrock principle essential to all our rights. Yet there was an aggressive campaign between 2020 and 2024 to curtail free speech on the internet and elsewhere by labeling it disinformation, misinformation, malinformation, or hate speech. Those standing in the defense of free speech were dismissed, in the words of one law professor's book, as members of a cult of the Constitution. This campaign followed a trend in Europe where speech is increasingly criminalized, but European laws never understood free speech as a natural right, and Europe's courts have never aggressively protected it. Here in the U.S., and on the other hand, one of the greatest triumphs for free speech came in the Supreme Court's 2023 decision, 303 Creative LLC versus Alenis, which held that Lori Smith, a Christian website designer, could refuse to provide services for a same-sex marriage. Justice Gorsuch, writing for the majority, argued that the framers designed the free speech clause of the First Amendment to protect the freedoms to think as you will and to speak as you think. They did so because they saw the freedom of speech both as an end and as a means. An end because the freedom to think and speak is among our inalienable human rights. Had 303 Creative been decided in a different way, states and cities could compel or curtail speech according to whatever their leaders viewed as discriminatory elements under public accommodations laws. Instead, the court adopted a bright-line rule that business owners could decline to create expressive products from cakes to websites. The counter-majoritarian function of the court worked in the 303 Creative decision to protect natural rights, regardless of whether it reflected the will of the Colorado majority. It upheld the right of free speech. We are living in a time of rage. It is not the first such time in our country. Indeed, America was born in rage. It was rage that fueled the Boston Tea Party. It was righteous rage, but rage all the same. It is especially during such periods that the judiciary must stand in defense of our individual natural rights. It is also especially during such times that we must stand as a people to prevent extremists of an ideological bent from politicizing or destroying our constitutional political system. Ironically, those establishment figures trying to cancel the court today are delusional and not foreseeing that they will be undermining their own freedom and security should they succeed. They might recall the answer of Abby Emanuel Joseph Sires, often described as the Thomas Paine of the French Revolution. To the question of what he had done during the revolution, "I survived," he said. The history of canceling courts is a history replete with unhappy endings. Courts are by necessity one of the first targets of revolutionaries. Following the October Revolution that brought the Bolsheviks to power in Russia, one of their first decrees was the abolition of existing legal institutions. Soon after came the establishment of the infamous People's Court. In revolution after revolution, newly established courts carried out the purported will of the people with terrible consequences. In an age of rage, it is too often reason itself that is canceled. Well, that concludes my podcast, 50B. I hope you found it informative and interesting, as well as I did. And hopefully, next week I will go ahead and do another one. And like I said, is maybe in the near future, I will toy around with the idea. I've already set up a backdrop behind me, so I have something to for people to look at when I do my podcast. And I've been investigating hardware and software options as well. So I hope you have a great day. And as always, watch your six. We are getting close to the midterm elections. Just a couple of months away. And so I don't know if you've been paying attention. Republicans had the first midterm rally, basically, or convention in Dallas. It was very interesting. I'm going to be watching. I've got it all taped, or should I say recorded, and I want to finish watching the second day. Trump had a pretty good speech on the first day, on Wednesday. And so who knows? But all I know is we can't keep this trend going with all of these socialists / communists that are getting in office. There is no such thing as a free ride or free anything. Somebody has to pay for it. And eventually, that someone will be us. So, well, we'll see what happens. All right, you have a great day.